If space junk is the human debris that litters the universe, junk space is the residue mankind leaves on the planet. The built product of modernization is not modern architecture, but junk space. Junk space is what remains after modernization has run its course, or more precisely, what coagulates while modernization is in progress, its fallout. Modernization had a rational program to share the blessings of science universally. Junk space is its apotheosis or meltdown. We have built more than did all previous generations put together, but somehow we do not register on the same scales. We do not leave pyramids. According to a new gospel of ugliness, there is already more junk space under construction in the 21st century than has survived from the 20th. Architecture disappeared in the 20th century. We've been reading a footnote under a microscope, hoping it would turn into a novel.
Space junk. This is like such a silly sentence, isn't it? It's like, hey! You're listening to a podcast about building cities. I'm George Gingell.
I'm Luke Jones. Junk Space is the name of an essay written by the Dutch architect Rem Koolhaas, founder of OMA, the Office for Metropolitan Architecture, which was first published in 2001 as part of the Harvard Guide to Shopping, produced by the Graduate School of Design as part of Koolhaas' research studio, The Project on the City. It's a description of the formless, disorientating environments created by the sprawling complexes of late 20th century capital, the shopping mall, airport, hotel, train station, spa, cinema, casino, in which order, meaning, identity and place seem to dissolve. It's a unique piece of writing, energized in Fred Jameson's description by a mixture of euphoria and repulsion. And we're going to explore it together, see what we think of it, and ask where it leaves us. Junk space is a fuzzy empire of blur, a low-grade purgatory, a perpetual jacuzzi with millions of your best friends, and it might also be the end of architecture. Right, shall we start by saying something about Rem?
He was, I think, at the time that we were starting our studies, the most prominent architectural theorist, certainly, and one of the most prominent figures in architecture, full stop, along with possibly Zaha. Someone who was almost at that time in the early noughties, I think, transcending the cultural world of architecture and breaking sort of into mainstream discussion, in the way that few figures in architecture do. I recall jokes about him.
Yes.
You know, and I think that's partly a product of his kind of style as a writer, which is very brash and in keeping with those times, which enabled him to become a public figure. Should we do the sort of bio details?
Yeah, so Koolhaas was known as a writer before he had done much in the way of architectural work. In particular, the 1978 book Delirious New York, which was this polemical retroactive manifesto for Manhattan, which claimed to lay out the implicit ideology of the New York's urban form and development. His architectural firm, OMA, became known for a succession of initially mostly unbuilt designs during the 1980s, and in the 90s for the publication of SMLXL, which simultaneously documented, collaged, and deconstructed the practices, work, and process. Yeah, as you say, he's extremely famous and notable for the way in which he's managed at some level to continue to maintain these parallel practices of critique and design.
I would like to say, although this might initially seem like information which is sort of aside from what we're going to talk about, he was born fairly near the end of the war in the Netherlands, and that's a sort of specific time and space, which I think it's important for the undertones of this, was educated in a fairly cosmopolitan fashion at various sort of prestigious architectural colleges. I can't remember them all, but it includes the AA, one in America.
Also lived abroad as a child.
And lived abroad, yeah. But in the age of the modernist reconstruction after the devastation.
And I don't know if this is the place to talk about it, but he's a very divisive figure and lots of people hate him. He's like, well, I think we should probably talk about this later, but he's someone who's incredibly sceptical of the ethical potential of architectural practice at all.
And human existence.
Yes.
And human motivation. You said in planning this, he's a nihilist, which is what attracts me to him.
Yeah. You think we are kidding or making with the funny stuff?
Yeah. Except you think you haven't dreamed of Lebowski.
Yeah, he believes in nothing.
He believes in nothing, Lebowski, nothing.
And tomorrow we come back and we cut off your Johnson.
Excuse me?
I said we cut off your Johnson!
So when I started, there's all kinds of terrible detail now. When I started architecture school, my architecture hero was Danny Libeskind. And then during first year, I was like, you know, actually,
that was an error.
This is bullshit. And then my second hero was Rem Koolhaas, and hasn't changed.
What was it with Libeskind?
Oh, I think that you can, like, if you think of the kind of the stories that he tells.
He's a good speaker. Have you seen his things for the London Met Building? He submitted a speech which is all about it, you know, points towards the North Star and is going to... And then he saw the people in front of him and said, like, this is going to incrementally increase commerce in the area. In essence. Anyway.
No, you buy a lot of bullshit at that age. Should we talk about what junk space is? It's not just shopping malls. I would describe it kind of as like the metastasis of the shopping mall, the outgrowth of the shopping mall to become a kind of ground condition which connects all sorts of different programs.
The way we're going to, like, it's not a structured essay. It's a prose poem. It's got some extremely late 90s, early noughties features in its writing. And it's more tonal than specific. And it is a continuous description of what junk space is, which at times can be something incredibly specific, you know, a particular sort of shopping condition, or any, more or less, any fraction of the modern social condition. Well, it starts, if you wanted a sense of the prose style, and actually it gets sort of progressively stranger as you go on, but it starts, rabbit is the new beef. Because we abhor the utilitarian, we condemn ourselves to a lifelong immersion in the arbitrary.
I was thinking about this today, and you have to think of it as kind of losing my edge.
Well, the next sentence is LAX, welcoming possibly flesh-eating orchids at the check-in counter. The next one is identity is the new... No, I mean, that sort of... And then there's a sentence which almost makes sense. Well, mainly I've underlined... At the beginning, when I was going through an underlying, I was mainly underlining the bits which actually say what junk space is rather than the thick packer in between them.
I think we have to take people in so that they have a sort of mental image of what it is before we start to explore it further.
Well, at one level, it's contemporary crapness.
Contemporary interior crapness and the kind of spreading...
It's the qualities of a shopping mall. Ideally, a shopping mall embedded within transport infrastructure with a sort of, I think, the underground... Yotel, probably like the bar in the capsule hotel inside the Heathrow car park. That's definitely junk space. Like with like in room continuous commercials, but it's done up like a luxury cabin in an aeroplane.
Yeah, and you never see the sun. It's he talks about this relationship to three technologies: the escalator, air conditioning, and plasterboard. I mean, he calls it sheetrock, but
these Americans. He's not even an American.
He's not even an American. What those things allow is for it to be kind of spreading and continuous, and you can kind of force people to constantly go up and downstairs because they've got escalators.
Yeah, I mean, I think the technologies he chooses are almost irrelevant. It's really the sort of... He could have chosen three other ones.
Yeah, like what? Like sushi, wheeled suitcases.
Yeah.
I think wheeled suitcases are vital to junk space.
Yeah, wheeled suitcases.
Oh, the important thing to say about it is that junk space, it's in the essay, is a condition and an experience, but it's inherently a reading of that condition through Koolhaas's own subjectivity. He's immersed in it. He's kind of susceptible to its charms, but he's also attempting to interpret everything he sees using the conceptual and disciplinary apparatus of architecture, looking at space, signs of intention, structure, hierarchy, organization. And the weirdness, the uncanny experience of junk space is discovered through the failure of this attempt to interpret it. But he's constantly trying to apply a certain set of conceptual tools to the spaces which he's passing through and finding that they fail or produce really weird results. So looking for hierarchy, looking for a diagram. So let's take a really obvious one, structure, which he talks about.
Yeah.
He says in something very strange happens to structure in junk space. Sometimes it's completely hidden. It's sort of groaning invisibly. It's doing all kinds of things which you can't really understand. Sometimes it's on display but completely fake. In the kind of classically modernist building, structure kind of is revealing what the building is doing and also the organisation of it. And in junk space, it's become...
He's worried by... It's the opposite of functionalist architecture, even when it's pretending to be functionalist architecture. He sort of says the corporation is trying, like, expresses itself through functionalism and delight. Yeah. But the architecture does not express its structure, or it can express its structure as rhetoric. He has a bit about high tech. Or it doesn't express the functions of circulation in any sort of clear way. You know, everything is just a hodgepodge of elements which are stuck together to support the immediate necessities of commerce.
Or not even that. So in terms of circulation, that in junk space, circulation becomes this sort of surreal dreamscape, which he talks about in he talks about as peristaltic.
Peristalsis. I can't even remember what it means. What does it mean?
It's the action of the large intestine, I think. Trajectories are launched as ramp, turn horizontal without any warning, intersect, fold down, suddenly emerge on a vertiginous balcony above a large void. Fascism minus dictator. From the sudden dead end, where you were dropped by a monumental granite staircase, an escalator takes you to an invisible destination, facing a provisional vista made of plaster, inspired by forgettable sources.
Right. I wish it was that exciting.
You do have these experiences of in airport terminals where you go down an escalator and then...
You go up
an escalator again, and then because some shop is being renovated, you kind of go through some strange little passage, and then you suddenly emerge into an enormous space, and then you go like again through another corridor, and then you go around like a big spiraling ramp.
Part of which actually is often functionalist route planning, like the Barbican, as we discussed there. A lot of this is like, if you put functionalist sort of like how people go round in complicated settings, what is legible on a plan has strange consequences in perspective.
Yeah, or also that these are just kind of, it's this layering of
Rerouting
of decisions and rerouting, yeah, which also becomes permanent.
Yeah, he's very keen on the shopping mall airport as being something which is continually refitted, which I guess... And that the refitting process degrades architectural intent, or degrades intent of any sort. Yeah. You know, if you want a classic example, like Stansted Airport, which was meant to be this single monolithic box, empty box, and is now a warren of weird shops and concessions and prayer spaces.
So should we go through some of the qualities of junk space, which are... in the text, and maybe explore their experiences. There's the first one I have is this sense of it being kind of endless and placeless, which I think is a factor of the kind of endless corridor experience.
Yeah, which I think the endlessness is two things. One of which is that in theory, it is for him trending towards a globally interconnected system of sort of air-conditioned. You know, you get on the plane, you fly to another prematurely air-conditioned shopping mall airport, are whisked seamlessly through this interconnected system. And another element is that it lacks any form of local specificity.
Yeah.
It is about expunging local difference.
Continuity is the essence of junk space. It exploits any invention that enables extension. Deploys the infrastructure of seamlessness, escalator, air conditioning, sprinkler, fire shutter, hot air curtain. It is always interior, so extensive that you rarely perceive limits. It promotes disorientation by any means, mirror, polish, echo. Junk space is sealed, held together not by structure, but by skin, like a bubble.
Over the sort of skeleton, there's a continuous stuck together...
Yeah.
Facade, which also sort of goes over and distorts the outer world.
Yeah.
You know, that's what it is to be interior, you're enveloped. The technology that he misses, which is one that's so banal, is light. Electric light, or industrial light of any form, allows a plan to be so deep that you have no connection to the outside,
yeah.
Which is the kind of necessary condition that you're, like, going round through so many, you know that sort of kids game of you walk out blindfold and spin around three times and then try and whack someone over the head with a rolled up newspaper or whatever the particular exercise is.
Yeah.
That the interior does that. It confuses you. You have no, like, placeable landmarks and you have no placeable relationship to the outdoors and you're confused, disorientated and unaware of your direction and location. That's something he likes.
Yeah.
Well, rather, he likes the consequence of it that it allows for a strange delight of unexpected clashes. I think one of the qualities he likes in Junk Space is you've got irony, you've got the sort of expressive irony, and you've got the contradiction and the delight in contradiction between, you know, the grandiose and the banal, the unexpected locations you wind up in. The kind of contradictions of catering to delights in a kind of capitalist way. The, like, excessive care that is lavished on things, but in a totally careless and automatic way. The unconscious driving a process that it sort of takes on a life of its own.
Yeah, the whiskey shops and the...
It would be like duty-free whiskey selling environments.
And the car, like, strange car raffle.
Yeah, the car raffles. It's amazing they're still going.
Yeah, people love them. And these kind of sunglasses shops or...
Yeah, which for me feel like the sort of cultural products equivalent to the mathematical horse of the 18th century or strange floating ephemera.
But they're floating, like, very deep. They're buried very deep in this... Yeah. In this structure.
His relationship with it is, I would say, that of a connoisseur.
If you look in the inside front page of SMLXL, it's got a graph of Rem's...
Air miles.
Air miles and how many days a year he's travelling, and it's...
There is a note underneath it as well, which has the point at which he carries only a toothbrush with him, and then the point at which he gets someone to buy a toothbrush for him.
Travelling something like 280 days a year or something in the, yeah. Towards the top of the graph. So yeah, he's just going from airport to airport, going from airport through shopping mall to hotel and back again.
And meeting in elite luxury.
Meeting in a conference centre, which is probably part of the shopping mall. So something which may contextualize the intention of this piece a little bit more is to talk very quickly about Delirious New York, which I think we'll probably talk about properly another time. But the rhetorically, like, the maneuver of Delirious New York is it's a retroactive manifesto. What it says is, can we identify, although it's unspoken or implicit, can we identify what the ideology of building Manhattan was about? And he comes up with all of these ideas which are actually sort of central to how it works, this idea of kind of intensification, this idea of verticality, of stacking all sorts of different programs on top of each other, what the effect of the grid is.
It's almost Rossian, the analysis, in that...
Yeah, weirdly it is, yeah.
In that it's that particular mash of regulation and culture... which gives rise to a specific urban condition.
But it's also, in a way, it's an exercise of, like, if a kind of hysterical avant-gardist of the early 20th century was going to propose Manhattan as an idea, how would they describe what it's going to be like and why you would do it? And Delirious New York is sort of that, really.
Yeah.
And Junk Space is not quite a retroactive manifesto, but it does try to define a sort of implicit philosophy and set of qualities to what's otherwise this emergent phenomenon of enormous shopping malls connecting every program everywhere.
Yes, he really likes Delirious New York, you know, incomprehension of sort of transit and commerce and grandeur. He has a complicated set of relationships with junk space.
Yeah.
Which is that he loves the aesthetic delight he gets in analysing it.
This contact with the surreal and bizarre.
I mean, he doesn't sort of say, you know, the moment of ecstasy is Santa Claus nailed to the cross in a Japanese shopping mall. But it's kind of that.
No, he's obviously has a taste for that. There's a good bit. When they do a project in Japan in SMLXL, there's like a bunch of weird Japanese pornography just stuck in the middle of it for no reason.
I think all his works have discussion of pornography in them at some point. It comes up about three times in this one.
You know, the transgressiveness of junk space, the transgression of all ethics, all norms, all values through just like kind of ignorance and kind of this sort of onrushing vitality.
When you're in an interchangeable space, when you're without a locality, you're not kind of bound by a local regulation. It's that thing of like, you know, peeing in the bath in a hotel. Not something incidentally I've done, but I mean, definitely, I'm much more for writing cryptic mirror image messages in the mirrors on the bathroom. You will die. So that, you know, when the person comes out of the shower and looks, you know. Anyway.
Aesthetic transgression and kind of ethical transgression.
And there's another bit of it, which is that he's got this fogeyish nostalgia for a not quite real functionalist, both culturally and architecturally past. There's a sort of streak of him that thinks this is disgusting, this future, because it's, you know, it conforms to a lot of those dystopian fantasies of consumption.
It's much more Huxley, Brave New World than it is
Brave New World. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that Kuhlhaas, and I think we can return to this in a bit, but Kuhlhaas has assimilated a certain sort of like functionalist dogma, a bit like Dutch Protestant guilt. But he's aware, but it's in his subconscious sort of acting on the way in which he's seeing all these things.
And it enables him to get really to have a sort of, it's not huh. It's like it's more the pun of, you know, neon is old, neon is new, everything is meaningless.
Yeah.
Isn't huh. I mean, we all pass these things every day and think this particular detail has an inherent irony. Commerce is like that.
Let me say one more thing about this endlessness that we were describing. Oh, no, well, you say what you were going to say, and then I'll...
I was to say that the real force of it is powered by the kind of Protestant guilt.
Yeah, I think that's in
about
there.
That really it should be utopia. But he's like Dante. He can't really write very convincingly about heaven. He can only convincingly write about hell, because that's actually what he's interested in. He's not actually interested, but he has these sort of like fogeyish returns when he alludes very unconvincingly to what virtue should be, when getting back into a much more precise and much more sort of witty and lifeful depiction of what he is at the same time reveling in and being slightly disgusted by. One of the difficult bifurcations I have in like summoning up memory of this is, at one length there's the obvious thing that it's like the huge shopping center near me, Westfield, which is a horrible place to spend any quantity of time in. It's this long slow curve, which means that you always have the same architectural, like, you can walk for a long time and see exactly the same shape. But it's also, because he depicts it in such a fruity way, it's also sort of like, you know, Ravnica's converted nuclear command bunker / cultural center shopping mall in Ljubljana, with its incredibly low ceiling covered in massive mirror tiles attached with plastic thumbtacks, where sort of people sell insurance from rickety camping desks. And talent, like, I was there and a talent contest was going on in one corner. There was a lonely drinks dispenser in the middle of the space, and then someone was selling insurance from a camp folding desk. And you walk out of this low, huge room into the massive, like, communist ballroom with air, like, aeroplane chairs and huge plastic one side, gilt on the other, light fittings and, you know, marble the colour of dried blood, which is a space, spaces which are accidentally brilliant and full of latent incomprehension, dealing with themes of sort of communism and the state and the adoption and colonization of capitalism through, you know, which is one thing, which he does. He talks about all of these properties, but he wants to lump them in with crap shopping malls and also with so many of the other complaints of the contemporary society that as you travel, you are traveling through nothingness, being stuck in queues, being blipped through, searched, commodified. And these feel like there is a through line between them, but the through line isn't the sort of vitality. The automatic passport control check-in desk does not have the same vitality, although it does have an interesting... The interest is brought to it by the people in the queue to the adopted post-communists, you know.
The richness of junk space is also allied to its superficiality and its kind of mutability, the amount that it changes. The classic junk space experience is travelling from one airport terminal of a certain age through like a corridor that's been subsequently upgraded into a shopping mall, into a different thing, into something else. And then also within that, everything is all constantly being upgraded on different cycles. And you'll pass, there's a moment where he talks about this kind of archaeology of carpet. Like, when was that particular thing being manufactured? Its richness is a terminal hollowness. It's flamboyant yet unmemorable, overripe and undernourishing at the same time.
Yeah. Utilitarian tables draped in white or black sheeps, perfunctory assemblies of caffeine and calories, cottage cheese, muffins and unripe grapes.
High tech. It seems so dead only a decade ago. It exposes what previous generations kept under wraps. Structures emerge like springs from a mattress. Exit stairs dangle in didactic trapeze. Probes thrust into space to deliver laboriously what is in fact omnipresent free air. Acres of glass hung from spidery cables. Tautly stretched skins enclose flaccid non-events. Transparency only reveals everything which you cannot in which you cannot partake. At the stroke of midnight, it may all revert to Taiwanese Gothic. In 3 years, it may segue into Nigerian 60s, Norwegian chalet, or default Christian. Earthlings now live in a kindergarten grotesque. Junk space thrives on design, but design dies in junk space. There is no form, only proliferation.
Modernism was a rare, if you include, well, sort of industrial period architecture, was the moment when the single architectural vision could encompass a whole chunk of something, you know. You were going through the Beaux-Arts repertoire of all the different buildings you can do as these single architectural functional visions. Yeah. And modernism takes that on to the next step. But urban agglomerations have always been the product of layered intents. Yeah. And an airport is like that. Heathrow has got a single driving purpose, but there's a myriad of layered intents that have been generated over years to create it.
Yeah, there is something particular, I think, about all of this design intent being piled into ShopFit, which is just this sort of endless application of kind of sheet materials and graphics.
Change is the lifeblood of retail. It's a particularly of non-essential retail, of luxury retail. And sort of non-essential retail is what you're trying to capture in duty-free lounges. Well, change and projected ethic. So it can be glitz if you're trying to sell Chanel, or wholesomeness if you're trying to sell posh brown bread sandwiches, or quinoa snack plastic shrink wrap packs.
But everything is under the like same hovering kind of ceiling tiles.
Yeah. But one thing's got stapled Hessian and mock wood, and one has got colour change, bright white LEDs, faux polished black granite, and gilt effect fringing. The Dubai Airport Irish pub with vacuum-formed plastic wood panelling meeting at the junction point with the mylar laminated chipboard of the standard unit, denoted by the changing carpet tiles. All of this is very exciting, being people who have like spent a lot, you know, being architects, you can't fail to be enthralled and excited by all of this contemporary irony and grotesqueness. I wouldn't possibly do something as grotesque and ridiculous as that. Incidentally, arises out of these things.
I think the complete disappearance of the kind of ethic projected by permanence and solidity. Yeah, in Junk Space, that has disappeared. Actually, the joint is one of the things he identifies, this thing. I mean, in modernism, like, the joint is a detail, isn't it?
Joints are where you put, like, detail flourishes to cover them up.
The joint is no longer a problem, an intellectual issue. Transitional moments are defined by stapling and taping. Wrinkly brown bands barely maintain the illusion of an unbroken surface. Verbs unknown and unthinkable in architectural history. Clamp, stick, fold, dump, glue, shoot, double, fuse have become indispensable. There's a sense of the interior of Junk Space is kind of like wrapping. It's like wrapping paper.
Actually, it reminded me of Strawberry Hill, our least loved podcast episode.
Oh yeah, it's got a little bit of that.
Where he's got all these theme rooms which are essentially made of cardboard and papier-mâché, duck down, peeling wallpaper to make, you know, something the inside of a gaudy hat box.
Yeah, that's Junk Space, isn't it?
Those verbs have always been part of architecture, actually. They're just part of the theatrical bent of temporary architecture. They're things that, like, are flung up and come as quickly down.
But now it's a permanent condition, but it's just a condition of...
Permanent replacement.
Permanent, yeah. Well, the other condition of Junk Space is this one of constant growth and accretion. The phrase he has is that it replaces hierarchy with accumulation, composition with addition. But maybe we can go on to something else here as well, which is that we've talked about kind of modularity and interchangeableness. But in fact, one of the key aspects of Junk Space is the fact that it's full of millions of innumerable, apparently original designs. It's not a space defined by the experience of like production line sameness, but actually of everything being, in this rather tragic and pathetic way, original and unique. He says, with enormous difficulty, budget, argument, negotiation, defamation, irregularity and uniqueness are constructed from identical elements. Instead of trying to wrest order from chaos, the picturesque is now wrested from the homogenized, the singular liberated from the standardized.
So what do you think that means? I had a few options in my brain for what he meant by
that. I have like a very strong image of these weird SketchUp designs being painstakingly built out of plasterboard, with, you know, the front of the shop is got this sort of diagonal thing, the ceiling is coming down in a unnecessary and faceted design, all of the spotlights are in a particular configuration. None of it is to any purpose. And in fact, all of these units are inhabiting a set of modular units, but everything has to be unique. And actually making it all unique is really difficult because everything is made out of sheet materials, which have been mass produced. So hence all of the joints and all of the taping.
And often there is a sort of variety which rises out of apathetic design production, like the production of the electrical diagram. I'm sure you've got to draw out where all the plug sockets go. And the process of doing that is always a process of just sort of going like plunk, 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 plunk. The lights will be here. Plunk, 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 plunk. And then that is manifested by someone you've never spoken to.
The process in which those designs are formed is a sort of concept thing where you draw lots of wiggly, unique forms, which then get laboriously made in horrible materials, and which are then subsequently massively debased by all of the services you haven't thought of being applied to them, basically.
Yeah, service ceiling services are lovely. It's a lovely world. I haven't worked in this for so long.
Yeah. But that is the thing, isn't
it? When was the last time you did a reflected ceiling diagram with, like, 5,000 sprinkler detection, scan, light, cooling... units.
Yeah, sometime.
Within all of which you're like trying to calculate the way in which they like reduce the effectiveness of the anti-acoustic.
Or modernism, or kind of post-war modernism, was often about trying to wrest a certain sculptural poetry from the use of repeated industrial elements, you know, panels, yeah. Like repeated louvers or whatever, you know, that you would have a single element which you would design quite carefully and which you would then repeat, and it would create something harmonious. And often, in this strange way, actually, the thing which appears to be very industrial is actually extremely handmade and quite expensive and difficult.
But, I mean, that is also the nature of industry. Industry is extremely handmade. Like, it's only very recently that, like, the batteries in cell phones are not made by people sticking sheets of stuff together. Recently, as in, it's still, to quite a great extent, that.
Whereas in junk space, all of that has disappeared. Every single kind of part of junk space is in this sort of Darwinian competition with every other part of it.
So, here's another question. As we're, like, going through your system, where is junk space? So we can discuss the world which is created by this description, but that is actually a world of recognition in Rome Koolhaas's eyes. It's like his collected repertoire of noted visions from his travels. Things I have seen while in airports. But actually it's the hyperreal in them. Because the stuff disappears when you only experience it briefly on the way to somewhere. And most life isn't really got very much of it in it. That wasn't what I was trying to say. I was trying to ask you, like...
Oh, right, yeah. Well, I mean, there's the question of where junk space... Where else is junk space? In some ways, the old-fashioned shopping mall is kind of dying. The out-of-towner is going. But what you have now is this kind of simulated urban space, which is actually a mall. In London, it's kind of things like all that area around the South Bank, for example, or all of these, like, this very much sort of crosses over with the kind of ground control polemic, I think. You know, like, everything, the
weird markets.
Box Park, Bissellfields, you know, they don't look like they're malls because they don't have doors, but they are.
Yeah, Spitalfields, I'd say, pushes that right to the end. I mean, it is basically a mall.
But junk's, you know, the mall has kind of gone under the skin of the city in these places.
Yeah, some of those more than... Yeah, I can see what you mean. So, yeah, you've got the sort of point of tourist landing being full of fake markets or sort of, you know, concession cubicle zones. Yeah. Within private streets, watched over and cared for by loving and underpaid security guards.
Yeah. Who I think have learnt to dial it back a bit. They used to do, you know, they used to, if they saw you taking photos, come up and tell you not to.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I had a street I did a project with Henrietta, and we did a thing, and then it got in the Evening Standard, and then they re-landscaped a little tiny street. Because we'd said it was like the apotheosis of contemporary grimness.
Oh, really? Excellent. That's a bit of agency. One of the things which we talked about a little bit in the planning of this is that junk space as an essay can seem a little bit of its time, but actually even at the time that it was written, and the most famous review of it by Frederick Jameson talks about, yeah, shopping malls seem to be dying, but... That just means that they're turning into something else again. You know, in terms of the writing style, one of the obvious antecedents for junk space is Walter Benjamin's Arcades project, which is also this kind of elliptical description of the shopping arcades of Paris, which at the time at which it was written was a description of a thing which was vanishing and had been, deprecated.
Yeah.
You know, the shopping arcades had gone, or they lurked, but they were in this kind of sad and decrepit state because the department store had been invented and had taken that on, and the department store now has mutated into the shopping mall, and the shopping mall is now mutating into the sort of pseudo urban quarter.
The story of the past desires can easily morph into a strange nostalgia. So while Benjamin is nostalgic for the longing gazes of bourgeois at the latest products of industrial luxury under the glittering glass road arcades of Paris. This is the sort of looking at But there's no desire. Where's desire in Junk Space? I can locate, like, desire in Benjamin is really, like, people really want those industrial products.
Actually, the experience of Junk Space is...
It's oversatiated.
Yes, it is. To borrow a phrase from Mark Fisher, this idea of kind of anhedonic hedonism, that the sort of the experience is that everyone is having has to have fun all the time, and everyone is kind of unable to feel joy. Yeah, constantly oscillating between kind of like extreme hedonistic behavior and depression. That's the Junk Spatial experience. It's the perpetual jacuzzi with millions of your friends.
Yeah. It's this kind of but how does that work when you're only in it when you pass through?
Well, you're always passing through, though.
Yeah, you're always passing through. That's it. The nature of it is it actually isn't... I mean, I suppose you might travel right along the vein of this spider if you're Rem Koolhaas. But for everyone else, you cut across it, you know.
But I'm not sure. I think that quite a lot of people's homes are junk space.
Yeah, I mean, he says, you know, the bachelor pad and the... But actually, the bachelor pads, in my experience, are not... Like, you remember that one we went to? Was it Ghent? Do you think that's junk space?
Maybe it had a tiny bit of it. But you see, like, a lot of houses which are 100% junk space. You got all the billies, you got the...
Got a lovely collection on this wall. But the billy is able to accommodate anything. I think it can even be junk... I think probably the ones we're looking at over the window have some junk space to them. But the junk space starts to disintegrate as soon as they're sort of inhabited and all the, like, washing machines appear on the balconies.
There's certainly quite a lot of junk space in the circulation. I think housing has become more junk spatial because of just how weird circulation is now. It's sort of not really designed.
Like, you immediately feel you're in somewhere generic when you have that, like, corridors that smell of sick because they are insufficiently ventilated.
Yeah, and everything is carpeted. The nature of junk space, I think, is that it's not really designed. It's like a remnant.
Yeah, which is how things always were, but it's a remnant which has been highly manufactured.
Like, it's extremely serviced and high-tech, but which displays no real intention.
And I would say that the not having lots of places not really having any intention is not new at all. Most stuff has always been non-intentional. It's the way that the non-intentional stuff has been drawn up on a computer and is now served. And the unintentional collection of strange shapes and things, all are digitally numbered.
Should we talk about modernism?
Yeah, well, I think we'd sort of attacked it a little bit already in that I was... Or at least I think I put my gamut out that like, he has got a desire for the functionalist, modernist, utopian future that was sort of all present in his youth, but mainly as like the Christian God to someone who is talking about sin.
To the extent that it's nostalgia in the sense of being an observation of the irrecoverability of something. Yeah, modernism is certainty, clarity, diagram, definiteness. He describes junk space at one point as the web without a spider. Architects could never explain space. Junk space is our punishment for their mystifications.
Functionalist circuit diagram people can't explain space, but we've just done something on Michelangelo. What is the Capitoline Hill if it is not space?
I think it's more that it's something which you're never able to pitch to people very effectively. Yeah. Like, this is a space, this is lovely. This is good. This is going to be nice.
But people have at times, and it's not architectural fault, but you could say capitalism struggles with space. You could say bureaucratic control struggles with romantic notion.
I think actually if we were going to talk about Rem's nostalgia for modernism, that it would take in like a certain fascination with totalitarian design, in fact. Like his... So he did I think his thesis project is all about the Berlin Wall, which is an extremely...
And how there are not enough of them.
Well, it's not quite like that. It's like, you know, the Berlin Wall is an extremely modernist gesture in a way. It's like a very clear diagram. His observation about the Berlin Wall is that it's the opposite of what everyone thinks it is. It's not that everyone is trying to get out, everyone is trying to get in. West Berlin is this little island with a wall about it, floating in the middle of East Germany, and everyone is trying to get inside the wall. And so he builds it into this thing, which I'm not sure you can really understand what it is, except that everything inside it is lovely. And it's this enormous Super Studio-like wall.
He takes the shape from Super Studio.
Everyone escapes inside it, and all kinds of things go on in there. The voluntary prisoners of architecture.
It's a rhetorical flourish.
Architects thought of junk space first and named it megastructure, the final solution to transcend their huge impasse. Like multiple Babels, huge superstructures would last through eternity, teeming with impermanent subsystems that would mutate over time, beyond their control. In junk space, the tables are turned. It is subsystem only, without superstructure. Orphaned particles in search of a framework or pattern. All materialization is provisional. Cutting, bending, tearing, coating. Construction has acquired a new softness, like tailoring. I mean, something very junk spatial which happened at Stansted is that they got all these low-cost airlines, so they just built like an incredibly crap shed on the end of one of the expensive terminals, and you go down some stairs into it, into this incredibly crap sort of annex, and that's where some of the like less glamorous Ryanair flights take off from,
as opposed to the big highly expressed structural modernist box. The megastructures were always pretty much theoretical, because even when they were built, they were not built as thought. The Barbican is not a town. It's a high-density housing, a luxury housing unit with a strange cultural centre in it. And I'm not sure that junk space... I'm not sure there is actually any junk space that is quite this rhetorically pure. Also, something I notice that's quite junk is the increasing amount of lettering and graphics. Buildings didn't used to have that much. Cities didn't used to have very much lettering and graphics in them. And they were relatively small. There always was some. They're like increasing proportion.
Yeah, lettering and graphics is like the main... That's the main content of architecture now.
Yeah.
Architecture is all basically graphics now.
Yeah.
So in his book on postmodernism, the cultural logic of late capitalism, which is this... It's one of this book that you've probably been made to read if you've done a like theory.
Have you read it?
No.
I haven't read it.
I've read a chapter of it.
Yeah, I've read a chapter or two as well.
But talking, what he talks about as the quality of postmodern space is this flatness, is the thing which he first identifies in a journey which he takes through the Bonaventure Hotel built by John Portman in Los Angeles in the 80s. Let me just find this quote and then we can... I am at a loss when it comes to conveying the experience of space you undergo when you step off the elevator into the lobby or atrium, with its great central column surrounded by a miniature lake, the whole positioned between the four symmetrical residential towers with their elevators, and surrounded by rising balconies capped by a kind of greenhouse roof at the sixth level. I am tempted to say that such space makes it impossible for us to use the language of volume or volumes any longer, since these are impossible to seize. Hanging streamers, indeed, suffuse this empty space in such a way as to distract systematically and deliberately from whatever form it might be supposed to have, while a constant busyness gives the feeling that emptiness here is absolutely packed, that it is an element within which you yourself are immersed, without any of that distance that formerly enabled the perception of perspective or volume. You were in this hyperspace up to your eyes and your body, and if it seemed before that suppression of depth I spoke of in postmodern painting or literature would necessarily be difficult to achieve in architecture itself, perhaps this bewildering immersion may now serve as the formal equivalent in the new medium.
Is the suppression of depth that you are so overstimulated you cannot, your brain is shocked to stop it from going anywhere beyond the superficial, because there is so much superficial density or delight, or you've got so much superficial stimulus that you are shocked beyond comprehending depth.
I mean, if you think, actually, the space in Westfield is a bit like this, the kind of the big curving space with the T-junction. You're never really meant to comprehend that you're in an enormous curve.
It's the same. Because it's a slow curve, it always looks the same.
Are these things meant to be legible? Are they meant to be legible as volume, or are they just meant to be kind of these events? In the case of the Bonaventure, which he's talking about, it's this, you kind of come in and go out at different levels, and that you're never really sure, because there's this repetition of these identical towers around a series of all of these different balconies and different levels and things moving up and down.
That's a key bit of it, isn't it? Disorientation and simulation, which makes you feel really grubby. Yeah. It's like, I get the same thing with listening to electronic music for too long. I find it initially highly stimulating, but then the, like, perfection, the identical repetition of sound, the perfection gives me a headache.
The most junk spacey bit of Westfield is actually Stratford International Train Station, yeah, which is the really sad...
I think the cycle access is extremely junk space, where you have to go along 500 metres of bin stalls up a weird dual carriageway to the previously 8 Sheffield Stand bike locks servicing this enormous complex, which have now been increased. There was a complaint that it was regarded that 16 bicycles parking spaces was slightly inadequate for this 4th or 5th largest shopping mall in Europe.
Yeah, having had a little bit of experience working on retail, there's a set of approaches to how you design shops. The reason Westfield is like it is because there is a tube station and a train station for the high speed line, and they've just fitted in as many shops as they can on the desire line between those two things. That's why it bends as well,
yeah,
is to fit in more.
This is something many architects will, like, one of my formative was transforming a Premier. It wasn't a Premier Inn. It was one or other of those brands. I even forget the name. And it had to go from 118 to 123 rooms within the same footprint.
But it's the thing, if you've ever wondered, why is perfume always at the entrance of department stores or these kind of things? And it's because that's the most expensive stuff. And the entrance is the bit which everyone has to walk through. And it's that simple. Put the things which you most want to sell and you have the biggest margin on the places where people have to walk past, and by the sort of law of averages, that means that you're going to sell more of that than you would placing it in any other place.
I mean, he's got an interesting bit where he talks about, like, shifting massively about the junk space of museums, which I liked a lot, actually. I thought this was... And there's a bit which I think must be talked... I mean, there are several examples, but the one that is really obvious is the British Museum roof. He talks about courtyards covered by filigrees of metal and glass. Yeah. That has a serious, like, unintended junk effect, which is that it makes it into a shopping mall. Because it's so loud. The acoustics are so bad in that space that you feel instantly disorientated. Whereas before, it was this really weird, but strangely orientating, like, mess of stacks.
Which they just all threw away. Yeah. Despite them being incredibly historically interesting. Anyway, just to return to the thing you were talking about before, I think this is one of the things I like about junk space, is that, yeah, it talks about the sort of postmodern hyperspatial experience, but it talks about it as, let me see if I can get this quote, the outcome of brilliant inventions lucidly planned by human intelligence.
Although I think he's being a little bit disingenuous there.
Yeah, a tiny bit, but it's that lots of people are trying very hard and being very smart, but the sum total of it all is something like meaningless and awful. I mean, he's prepared to talk about the complicity of contemporary global architecture in the production of junk space. He talks about junk signature, TM.
Yeah, yeah, the whole thing. I mean, this whole essay is a branding exercise. He is trying to brand. He's trying to put his brand on contemporary crapness.
Yeah.
Like, junk space is like a branding exercise for his rhetorical package of ideas. And then he literally puts TM on loads of things in the writing. So it's like, you know... What are they? There's several.
It's super, like late 90s.
It's that era of the sort of neuroses under American confidence. The Cold War is won. Yeah. Everything hasn't fallen apart. We haven't had the Iraq. It's the period between the Cold War and the Iraq War.
Yeah, I think that this must come out just before September the 11th, actually. It is. It is the end of the 90s.
It's all this sort of neurosis about nothing which hides terrific confidence. I was recently at the American print exhibition at the British Museum, and it's all of this, like, ironization of, like, contemporary luxury, which really is a confident society making a sort of superficial criticism of itself. And the 90s is that sort of era, and this, I think, is that sort of thing.
It places him in an interesting position as a star architect to talking in this quite apocalyptic way about the future of architecture and...
Yeah, the register is that of the Dystopias episode. It's...
Yeah. He also talks about the way in which architects, like, they whatever the intentions they start out with, they end up creating more junk space. That junk space is the sort of inevitable condition of all architecture.
A lot of his buildings are quite junk space.
Although, if you look at the rhetoric of them, like, I'd say modernism is still the biggest component. If you think of something like the Seattle Public Library, it's all about this demonstrative collage of programmatic functions. Everything gets amalgamated and then cut up again and then moved around and then there's
satirical
the
modernism. But a lot of them are also just, like, generic boxes. Some of the sort of early, like, arts centres are seriously...
satirical modernism and also sort of self-satire as the architect, which goes on quite late. If you think of Casa de Musica in Porto, I wonder how
we visited that together a long time ago.
I wonder how he sold it, but, like, essentially the joke of that is that they had a design for a house which didn't go ahead, and then they decided to make it, like, five times as big and turn it into a concert hall. There was, like, a mad circulation idea in the house, which...
Oh, it was meant to be, like, several, like, different family members didn't want to have to cross each other's path for this eccentric rich family. Something we can all sympathise with. So. I think, wasn't it? I can't really remember the story. And it's full of... There's a room full of smashed Porto tiles, I remember, in a, like, smashed shape. And then the next level of irony is it's covered in arbitrary architecture design. The gold leaf panels. Like, in some digitally generated form in the concert hall, having some nominal effect on the acoustics. Yeah. The, like, panel of acoustic wiggle glass, which doesn't really work, but does have a sort of rhetorical purpose. Because we abhor the utilitarian, we have condemned ourselves to a lifelong immersion in the arbitrary.
I think one of the things I really enjoy about this essay is that although it pertains to the present, although I think it is acute in some of its observations, especially the more surreal ones, it's
picking out from the world the moments of the most acute realization of a non-existent future and combining them into an entire world of junk space, which is this perfectly cherry-picked gothic fantasy of a high capitalist future, which is science fiction. Science fiction always can only take the contemporary and manipulate it.
He says, unwittingly, all architects may be working on the same building, which is this kind of rather delicious idea that they're all going to...
But sort of spurious.
They're all going to link up. There's this Jameson phrase about shopping as kind of toxic moss. It's like toxic moss spreading across the planet.
But now we've got Airbnb... And we don't stay in travel lodges anymore. We go to Frankfurt and stay with, like, Herr Braun and their weird little shiatsu, you know, and experience their strange particularities. We now, like, fly around the world and experience the random thing picked out by TripAdvisor on account of some strange snowballing effect.
The other thing which is very science fictional about it is and maybe we did talk about this briefly, but the way in which junk space ages is incredibly science fictional. Yeah. The way in which it suddenly... Where is it? Yeah. He talks about aging as non-existent or catastrophic. Suddenly, and also this is because of these seamless transition between structures of different ages or on different kind of periodicities of renovation. So that you suddenly enter a place where all of the ceiling tiles have fallen down and there's water dripping.
Because it is endless, it always leaks somewhere in junk space. In the worst case, monumental ashtrays catch intermittent drops of grey broth.
In one of the reviews, Jameson likens this to these kind of Philip K. Dick environments. A bit, you know, like Ubik, in which the narrator is... disorientatingly and unexpectedly constantly being sucked back in time, so that the world in which he is constantly shifting. Things are constantly, like, the coffee in his hand is suddenly full of mold. He's suddenly back in the 1950s for no reason. The ground is moving under his feet.
A monumental ashtray catching intermediate drops of grey broth. That's what happens when you slice open a spaceship. That's the ooze. That's the sort of Ballardian ooze of, you know, an organic house cut.
Aging in junk space is non-existent or catastrophic. Sometimes an entire junk space, a department store, a nightclub, a bachelor pad, turns into a slum overnight without warning. Wattage diminishes imperceptibly, letters drop out of signs, air conditioning units start dripping, cracks appear as if from otherwise unregistered earthquakes, sections rot, are no longer viable, but remain joined to the flesh of the main body via gangrenous passages.
That's only like that because you're a business class passenger who's just flown into JFK or Hangzhou and hasn't been there for 2 years and has suddenly noticed that something that you hadn't noticed before has happened. It's only imperceptible if you're this particle in the synchrotron of international nowhere.
I think the immediacy is actually... That's actually, it's the experience of immediacy. It's actually about adjacency. It's that your route leads you from one thing through another. Mankind is always going on about architecture. What if space started looking at mankind? Will junk space invade the body through the vibes of the cell phone? Has it already through Botox injections, collagen, silicon implants, liposuction, penis enlargements? Does gene therapy announce a total re-engineering according to junk space? Is each of us a mini construction site? Is mankind the sum of 3 to 5 billion individual upgrades? Is it a repertoire of reconfiguration that facilitates the intromission of a new species into its self-made junk sphere? The cosmetic is the new cosmic.
Forests are felled, their wood is all pale. Maybe the origins of junk space go back to the kindergarten. Origins is a mint shampoo that stings the anal region.
I was wondering if we could make an analogy that, like Origins, a mint shampoo that stings the anal region. We're going to leave you tantalised.
Titillated.
Ultimately unfulfilled. Should we do a proper sign-off?
I think it would be inappropriate. It should just end on an ellipsis.
Oh, really? It
should just drone. And then there should be a, calling Mr. Ocean to desk number 9. Mr. Ocean to desk number 9. And then the bomb explodes, spreading the toughened glass over the Hermes bags in the travel lounge as the cacophony of the poor surge in. The ceiling collapses and grey ooze drips from every pore. Mr. Ocean.
Why is it Mr. Ocean?
Because it's mythic, maybe? Or did you want to do a proper one? Well, follow us on Twitter.
Yeah, follow us on Twitter. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram.
Review us on iTunes.
Yeah. Twitter and Instagram were about _ buildings. Yeah, review us on iTunes.
Maybe not based exclusively on this episode.
Email us at aboutbuildingsandcities@gmail.com. Tell your friends that we're good. Even if you don't think so. Yourself.
I was there. Zaha announced Mama Architecture. I was there when Cool House proposed the revolutionary rotating ice skyscraper for Dubai. No. For us, it's the unremembered 90s. Black turtlenecks, back painted acetate.